Hello and welcome back to the wide world of wargaming. As always, I am your host, Alex Gonzalez, with my great and lovely co-host, John. Garrett is out tonight, as with Matthew and Jeremy. Everyone's got a lot of busy stuff going on, but we got a lot to talk about tonight, and we are going to be reviewing a couple of events, specifically Attack X in British Columbia and the London GT, the main event. We're also going to be taking a closer look at well, I don't want to call it my favorite unit, but the unit I'm seeing more and more, at least two-thirds of my game, the wonderful, the glorious, the annoying, the Screaming Bell. John, what's on your workbench today?
Hey, Alex, how the heck are you doing, sir?
I'm doing
well.
Great.
It is a fine, fine day out here in the Bay Area. Did you know it rained here this morning? It was pretty amazing. I got up, lots of rain happening. I can tell you, folks, I can't think of 5 or 6 Septembers in my life when it's rained here in the Bay Area. So that was pretty amazing. Plus all the extra accidents. So super fun. As far as what's on my workbench, oh man, you know, thinking back to earlier this summer, I am enjoying a little bit of the Glenlivet 12 that was given to me by Mr. Daniel Callahan. Always a fine beverage for a Monday evening. As far as my actual workbench, don't tell anybody, Alex, but I've been building some Primaris. As you know, over in the 40K side, I play Ultramarines and Dark Angels. I've been resisting building Primaris, so I went ahead and bought myself all the Primaris, and I'm building them in kind of a neutral scheme so I can run them as whatever the hell I want going forward. So that's kind of what's been going on physically. Other than that, you know, I did manage to get a couple things on. I don't know if any of you guys follow me on Facebook, but I threw a nice video up there of me eating the yellow Carolina Reaper with my buddy Phil last weekend. And then I got in a game with my buddy Anthony Webb, who lives down here in the South Valley with me as well. Some of you may remember Anthony back in the Warhammer Fantasy days. He was definitely one of the top players out here on the West Coast. He and I have played a few times over the years, and it was nice to go down and play a game with him. So he brought out his Gloomspite Gits, and I don't mean to shock anybody with this, but I actually broke out my Idunith Deepkin. Though I'm probably going to still play Skaven at GTs for the rest of the season, at this point I'm probably going to play Idunith for all of my RTTs, League, and other types of games. So what do you think about that, Alex? A little Idunith action, huh?
I think Idunith.
Anyways.
Yeah, that's yeah. Good.
That's good, right? So Anthony and I, we played Duality of Death, and he, of course, had Gloomspite Gits, Cave Shaman, Loon Boss on the Mangler Squig, some Squig Herds, Boyne Grot Bounders, all of that stuff. He gave me the top of the turn, and I think I actually got top of the turn by having one fewer drop than him. I started with my thralls off the board, and first turn I brought them in and I slammed them into his line, and I think I just got them a little bit too close to his Loon Boss on the Mangler Squig. So his counterattack basically wiped out all of my foot troops. So opening turn, I was in pretty bad shape. I actually just had 2 units of eels, my Achillean King, and a Soul Scryer left at that point. But I had put the eels on both of the objectives, and this is Duality of Death. And while he was busy killing all of my foot troops, I'm holding that objective. And this is the one where, you know, the first turn you hold an objective, you get 1 point. The second turn you hold an objective, you get 2. Third, 3. Okay. And I was able to maintain control of those objectives, one of them for 3 full turns, the other one for 2 turns. And in the meantime, he had only scored 1 point. And that was going into turn 4. He tabled me. Well, excuse me. It came down literally, I don't know if you guys know, but I think it's the Squig Herds. I'm pretty sure it's the Squig Herds. But when they fail Battle Shock, he rolls a dice, and on a 4+, I take a mortal wound. Well, guess what? I had 1 eel left on the table with 1 wound holding an objective. Yep. Had he not rolled that 4+, I would have held the objective one more turn, and I would have won the mission, no chance of losing. Wouldn't you know, he rolled that 4+, the one mortal wound killed my eel, and he was able to tie the game. And, of course, at that point, he did win on kill points and got a minor victory. So, Anthony, if you're out there listening, great game, my friend. I look forward to our next game. And so that is my week and what was on my workbench. Alex, tell me what the heck you have been up to, my friend. We haven't talked in a few days.
No, we haven't. Yeah, you know, my workbench is busy. It's a messy table, not for AOS, unfortunately. I am slowly, let's just call it, building the funds up for the Ossark Reapers. I want to start them because I'm excited about models and conversion ideas, but I don't know the rules yet, so I don't know how they're going to play. And quite frankly, if they don't play the way that I would enjoy it, I'm not going to play the army. You know, I tried that with Legion. You know, I didn't actually enjoy playing like a Legion army, but I was like, well, it's good and it can do well for me. But I wasn't really enjoying myself during the games as much as I do with, say, Nighthaunt. So I was like, well, you know, it's a lot better when you play an army you enjoy. So definitely waiting for that. And you know, of course, my Nighthaunt are fully painted, fully put together, fully based. So there's no need to jump in right now for that. But I'm still working on my Chaos Knights. Again, 40K, blasphemy. But I got my Castigator in the mail on Friday. And so I've been building him up, converting him up, making him a little chaos-y. And, you know, making a few dread blades and getting everything converted, just waiting on a few 3D printed bits that our good friend Casey has told me for a couple of months were in process. So we're playing the waiting game there.
That's how it is.
But that is basically what is on my workbench as well. So I also have some 40K there. That'll come in time. And our good friend and co-host Matthew is going to be painting them up for me. So,
oh, is he really? Oh, very nice. You're talking about the Chaos Knights that you're building. Is that correct?
That's right. And, you know, they're a household that it's like the only one that didn't have a color scheme or that have a color scheme, but didn't have like a model in the Codex. And I've only been able to see like one hobbyist online who's even starting the army. In the colors that I have, which is like an acid green and black. It's a specific household, House Effect Tricks, or Vex Tricks. So I'm going to be really excited to do that because it's all going to be based around, you know, Necrons. So, you know, I can use both my armies and probably share a display board. So.
Oh, that's nice. Awesome.
Yeah.
I've done a little bit of that cross army display board action myself over time. It's nice when you can pull that off.
Exactly. So hopefully we can. But we're not here to talk about 40K. We're here to talk about AOS. And with that, there was a lot that has gone on. This last weekend, there was, again, as we mentioned, a GT and essentially a major event. The GT, of course, was Attack X. That was in British Columbia. That was in Kalumps, British Columbia. And, you know, it had a good number of players. It was 34 players overall. You know, there's taking a look here. Our good friend Jack Ballard went with his Stormcast. You know, he got 9th place. From what solid. I can tell, his exact same list is at Nova. You know, our good friend Dan Miner was there, you know, of T-Shift and Cruise Hammer fame.
Now, he was the TO for the 40K side of things, right?
This year, I don't think he was a TO at all. I think, because he actually played in AOS this year for the GT at T-Shift, now named the Cascadia Open. So my apologies for that.
Because, you know, the Attack X Tabletop Wargaming Expo had had quite a few different events going on, and I'm pretty sure I saw Dan listed as one of the 40K TOs.
Oh, you meant for Attack X. My apologies. I thought you were talking about the Age of Sigmar event for T or the 40K event for T-Shift. So.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Okay. Yeah. No, I could not speak for certain, you know, what may have gone on there. So yeah, no. But, you know, he's a great guy and, you know, he's always an enjoyable time. He's always a party. Taking a look at this event, I was very surprised to see these final standings.
Oh, right.
John, were you able to take a little peek at that?
Yeah, man, I sure was. You know, Alex, I was totally amazed. I haven't seen this for a while, but would you believe the highest Hedonites of Slaanesh player took 8th? And we have in first place, Blades of Khorne. Second place, Blades of Khorne. That's Nick 14. And of course, we have third place, Colton Boivnecht. Oh, man, I would have to work on that name. I apologize, Colton. Anyways, grand host of Nagash. And, of course, Mr. Alex Little playing Skaven, taking 4th. So we have Blades of Khorne, Nagash, Skaven, and then Blades of Khorne again, rounding out the top 5. So pretty happy to see that kind of action. Plus a few other Blades of Khorne in the top 10, another Skaven in the top 10, all good.
I gotta tell you, I was very surprised at that in particular. I mean, seeing Blades of Khorne isn't uncommon, of course. You know, almost every event will have at least a good handful of Khorne players. I mean, they're a popular army, their model line is gorgeous, it makes a lot of sense. But right now, I mean, it's arguable, but for right now, at least in my opinion, they are the weakest Chaos God in terms of power level. So...
That may be true, but I think that as Khorne players are starting to get better and better at the judgments, that there might be a bit more of a toolkit there than there was at first glance.
I see that. I would believe that for sure. Definitely not going to deny that at all. But it is curious to me because they're not in the strongest place right now. By no means are they the weakest army by any sense of the word, but yeah, they're just not quite there. I mean, no one's at Hedonite level, of course, but
right.
They're not really at the same level Nurgle is, and they're certainly not okay. They're certainly also not at the same level Skaven are at.
If you want to talk about the 5 Chaos factions, right? If you want to include Skaven as one of the Chaos gods,
they are
the Great Horned Rat. So then, you know, I myself would definitely put Hedonites on top of that list. Skaven at a close second. I honestly would put Khorne in 3rd, and it's a toss-up for me between Tzeentch and Nurgle. Tzeentch might be stronger, but it requires a more skilled and experienced player. Someone like Joe Cryer out there obviously can still tear it up with the Tzeentch, but I think most players are not going to be that strong with Tzeentch. Whereas Nurgle, though it can be wielded well, I think kind of sits at a middle-high tier almost no matter who is driving the Nurgle. So it's a solid army, but maybe not the best. That would be my opinion of where the 5 Chaos Gods rank. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, great question. You know, I don't know if I completely share that sentiment. I obviously also agree that Hedonites are number 1 to the point where it's like, what were the playtesters thinking? I'm not going to go out there and like be like, oh man, they need a nerf or whatever to the same degree as, you know, others might, but I'm willing to admit that it is a crazy strong army to the point where, yeah, playtesting might've been slightly overlooked on this one. Looking at Skaven, I would put them solidly in 2nd place. I wouldn't necessarily say that they are completely overpowered. When I fought against you, I played 5 games against Skaven over the, you know, Nova events in total, you know, including our practice game. So, you know, seeing Skaven work in a very particular way, you know, I did realize that it's a very strong army, and my mistakes, the game that I had lost, and of course our game that was very, very close, you know, I knew the mistakes I made, and they were my mistakes. They weren't necessarily like huge things that, you know, they were my mistakes that you or James took advantage of. You know, they weren't like these things where it's like, well, I guess I can't do much about that. Like, this just happened and it's in my face. And it was completely unavoidable. And here we go.
Right. It's a matter of, you know, were you beaten or did you lose? You know?
Yes.
And a lot of times we find out, you know, as you're hinting at right here, we lose because of our mistakes rather than necessarily being beaten by the other opponent.
Yes. And I can tell you my explicit mistakes against, Matthew, and I can tell you my explicit mistakes against James.
Of course you can, because you know something? You never learn by winning.
No. Sometimes, but not often.
Well, you don't learn much.
You don't learn much.
To be a dick and an elitist.
Yeah, there you go. Jesus. But yeah, you know, it is very interesting to me that Korn was there, because I think that Korn is in a very similar place. It's almost a tie for third for me between Nurgle and Korn. Armies you've seen win events, big and small.
Yep.
But looking over the armies, at least Nurgle has a lot of resilience factor there. And if the person has a very good and put together list, they're going to do very well. And that's going to be a list not necessarily designed against opponents, but designed with the missions in mind, just like playing Nighthawk. Whereas with Korn, you're slow. It takes a long time for you to build your points for the most part. You got a couple of very specific builds that are really, really good when we take a look at utilizing the Bloodthirsters or the Judgments of Korn, as you mentioned earlier. And of course, you know, Gore Pilgrims are always going to be a thing, but I don't think it's on the same level. You know, I agree. I don't think that they're a low tier army. They're certainly mid to mid high tier, but they're definitely not top tier.
So what I mean, now looking here at this Attack X GT, I mean, I will say there were not a lot of Hedonite players, but you know, they didn't do particularly well. And I'm looking at, you know, three Korn players out of the top five. I mean, that's saying something to me, Alex. That's saying a lot, actually.
I understand, and I am excited to see what happens next.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. So, you know, as I look at this, though, I mean, we have to start asking ourselves, and we're not going to go into this in-depth analysis tonight, nor would I really expect anyone to want to hear us do that. But, you know, it starts getting down to, like you would have to, I think, look at the matchups and pairings that everybody had. You know, was there a clear path to victory? Did they avoid any hard counters as they got there? You know, what were the details? You know, did the guys that were playing the Hedonites happen to come up against the exact armies that would destroy them? You know, for example, my Skaven does pretty well against Hedonites. So is that who he played, you know, round one or something? Hard to say without doing a little more in-depth analysis. But I think there is a story. There's a reason there. Now, on the flip side, it might just be that Riley, Nick, and Chris are all top amazing Korn players. And I'm sure they're all excellent Korn players and just came in and stomped against the competition. But I think that we would actually have to look at matchings and pairings to see how we ended up with so much Korn up top in this particular event. Now, Alex, did you take a look at the winning lists at all?
Yeah. I mean, taking a look at Riley, you know, he did bring, two Bloodthirsters, one of Insensate Rage, one of Unfettered Fury, and then a Wrath of Korn Bloodthirsters. So just like we talked about before, just having a lot of those Bloodthirsters is definitely going to be helpful. I'm looking at Gore Pilgrims as per usual, as well as Tyrants of Blood Battalions.
Right. Isn't the Tyrants of Blood the one where you take the three Bloodthirsters?
That is, yes. So, I mean, it fits in line with what we were just talking about in terms of power level for Korn armies right now and very specific builds, you know? So it is going to be a lower drop army. They have access to two artifacts, which, you know, Glyph Strike on a Bloodthirster is no joke.
Right. And he actually has three artifacts in that army. So
yeah, because of the two battalions. So he's got a lot working for him, and that's going to be really, really, really important right now. So yeah, it's, there's a reason why it's there and it is the way it is. You know, when we look at some of these other lists, you know, there's looking at the comparison between him and Nick. You know, so two Korn players right next to each other, you know, they both are using the same units in different ways. And, you know, Nick doesn't actually have a battalion, but
nope.
They both have those Judgments of Khorne, which you mentioned a little earlier. And of course, you know, the Wrath Axe and the Hex Gore were used by Riley, whereas the Hex Gore and they were also used by Nick. So that's the one kind of commonality between their two lists.
Yeah, and again, I think that if you have the right matchups, and you're using that Khorne stuff to shut not just make magic difficult, but completely shut down and punish the magic phase from your opponent. If you're facing against armies that really rely heavily on magic to give them their primary mechanics, I think you've already put them on their back feet. And then you got all that other stuff. You run in, smash them up while they have no buffs and can't do anything about it. This is, I think there's some potential here. Again, I think it comes down to smart play of those judgments.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you on that. Just being able to not fuck it up is going to be super, super important.
Right?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to see how well they were able to do and work with, you know, what they had, of course. Looking at, you know, the fourth or the third place, you know, this grand host.
Tell us what you think of that. Well, after that, I'll talk a little bit about the fourth place Skaven list there. But tell me what I'm looking at when I'm looking here at Colton awesome last names list.
I think because I know someone who had a very similar latter part of his last name, I may also butcher this also Colton, but I'm pretty sure it's Balconnect. Just
Bow Connect,
just because of the pronunciation of someone I used to know, with the last six letters of that name.
You know, I could go with Bow Connect, depending on the nationality. I was going more Slavic in a pronunciation, but I think you're right. So Bow Connect. So Colton, if you're out there listening in podcast land, one, we apologize if we have butchered your name. If we got it right, wow, right? First people ever. But I would love for you to send me a little PM with the proper pronunciation of your name, and I will work on it and master it if you do so, sir. So,
agreed.
Looking forward to a message from you. Anyways, Alex, tell us about Colton's list.
Well, you know, it's a Legion of Nagash, and he has Nagash himself in there. So all it is Nagash gets, he's 850 points and a Necromancer, 40 skeletons, and 120 zombies. Super simple. You hold bodies because in a Grand Host, there's so many different ways to bring at least D3 models back to all the units overall, just with Nagash on the table itself, being a Grand Host itself, the grave sites, etc. And of course, Nagash is one of those things where that one model alone will, you know, just completely shut down an opponent's magic phase or hero phase in terms of magic spells. So there's a whole level there to consider. But when we look at, you know, just the fact of the matter of just keeping board control, it's a slow army, and you know, Nagash is not invincible. He's very hard to kill, but he's not that hard to kill. So if someone
he's not like so many big creatures like him. He's one of those things that you need to ignore him until the moment you're ready to kill him, and then you need to kill him now.
Exactly. So he's great, but he's not that great, and that's where my main takeaway is for him specifically. Looking at his list, I mean, it's good. Right now, we're all waiting for, again, the Ossark Reaper book, because we know that Nagash and Ark in the Black are actually both going to be in the Ossark Reaper battle tome. As a special version of them in that army, but more updated war scroll. And it makes sense because the Ossark Reapers stuff is all about like molded, people call them bone casts because they're basically souls that Nagash has been keeping bound into bone that has been molded into new shapes. So it is kind of like golems made of bone that has been reshaped. That's why you see all those real strange and interesting looking aesthetic. And in addition,
right. Like the skull cod piece.
Yeah, like the skull. I'm calling him the crotch goblin.
Crotch goblin works. I was going for skull cod piece, trying to be a little more polite.
You know, my apologies, actually. Not only is Nagash and Arcan in there, because you can see, of course, the Mortarks' mounts are some sort of molded bone. They don't really look like they're one particular creature. Nagash is Nagash. But the Morghast, both the Morghast Harbingers and Morghast Archai, are both going to be in that book as well, because they are like creatures of molded bone. And that was even their end times rules. They were built off of the bones of like mystical creatures and like heroes.
Cool.
So that fits in line there. So Nagash apparently is getting a rules update, and from what I've been told, and I quote, the new rules will make him worth 850 points.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know what that means. I'm hopeful, but I'm not going to hold my breath. I will not.
Well, we just saw Gortrek Gurnison, so we know they are willing to go a little crazy.
We know that they are willing to go a little crazy, especially if someone's going to continue to be 850 points. So we'll see there. But, that is something that is pretty interesting here. Final list I do want to take a look at for Attack X before we move on was going to be the fifth player, and that was also Blades of Khorne. And you know what's really interesting is it is a lot simpler than the other two, than first and second place. You know, this is of course run by Alex Little, and my apologies, this is not fifth place, this is fourth place. And you know what, we totally skipped the Skaven player. So Alex.
Yeah, you did. I'm literally typing angrily into our chat at you, you bastard.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Skaven list?
Yeah, I can. Oh, okay. First off, Mr. Alex Little playing Skaven took fourth place. He had four wins with 10 points and then 2 points in his last round. And if you have BCP, if you have a BCP subscription, so you can take a look at his list here. All I got to say, sir, is I applaud you, Alex. I applaud the way you wrote your list, because there is nothing more Skaven-y than writing a list in a way that makes it difficult for your opponents to read and interpret what they're at. At first glance, I said to myself, wow, did his list cut off? Does he even have a whole list here? But no, crammed into the various lines, what we can see, he brought a Verminlord Warpseer with, of course, Master of Magic and the Grifffeather Charm. Interesting choice. He also has two Plague Priests on Plague Furnaces, and he's running, that is 140 Plague Monks, Warp Lightning Vortex, and the Vermintide Endless Spell. I think this is a pretty straightforward list. He's using those two furnaces to give reroll wounds on the monks wherever he can. That Verminlord Warp Seer is giving him all kinds of command points and all of that, so he can do all of his command abilities throughout the game. And he's just going to shove a whole bunch of monks in your face, and it's up to you to kill them before they kill you. He doesn't have any death frenzy in this list, so that's something we've kind of become used to seeing. I'd be interested to see how he took advantage of the Grifffeather Charm. But I can tell you, as someone who runs the Warp Seer, I often wish that guy had fly. He just kind of gets caught behind everything. And every once in a while, you wish you could just jump him over the troops, go out and smack something, and then kind of jump back. So it might be a little bit of that going
on. Well, you know that the Grifffeather Charm doesn't give him fly.
Oh, it doesn't? What does it give us then?
It gives a -1 to hit, the bearer of the Grifffeather, and it's +1 to move.
Oh, it's just +1 to move. It doesn't give you.
No,
fly.
You're thinking of the Thermal Rider cloak for Ashkri.
Oh, yes, you're right. You're right. I just saw a feather and thought of flying. Well, in that case, an extra inch of movement. Okay, -1 to hit. That's nice. If you combine that No, because he's not going to get the lookout, sir, since he's a monstrous creature. Meh, that's about it. I'm thinking that that our buddy Alex here basically just came up to the board, played tactically, went played the mission, grabbed objectives, and held out, you know, and then basically it's hard to chew through, you know, 140 monks like that.
Yeah, and you know what? Congratulations, Alex, on getting fourth place with that kind of list. It's definitely very scaveny. And yeah, congratulations on all the winners overall at the TACX GT. Now, there was that other event. There was the London GT, which didn't have 30-some-odd players. I believe it had quite a bit more than that. You know, there were definitely many people who went to the London GT. I'm trying to find a final count. Unfortunately, I'm not really finding a lot of that here. But, you know, there was a lot to be said. Of course, the London GT is famous and infamous for several different reasons. But, you know, the armies have looked gorgeous year by year. There's a big, you know, a big following. You know, on Rob from the Honest Wargamer attends. I know Games Workshop has some presence there. And, you know, it was a huge event overall. Looking at London GT, you know, let's start off with taking a look at the pack. You know, that they did have 2 hour and 45 minute rounds, which I'm finding to be a lot more frequent now than just 2.5. Of course, 2,000 points, General's Handbook, we all know that. And the realm artifacts from play and spells, realms of battle were not used, which I'm, I guess, lukewarm to. And they only had 12 of the 18 hidden agendas, which I found to be very interesting, but you could select two each game that you could use, which was really, really weird to me. What were your thoughts on that, John?
Well, gee, Alex, that was the part I was going to cover. That's my thoughts on it. Anyways, I think it was a pretty reasonable start off. You know, the thing that kind of found was interesting, they are using mercenaries, and there is, it's kind of become accepted that people want mercenaries, so I'm seeing them pretty frequently, but I think it's still questionable about whether they're actually fully intended for match play, so I thought that was kind of interesting. The scenery was pre-rolled and placed by the organizers, and it's worth mentioning that they did not allow any of the war scrolls for scenery. So even if it was a GW scenery piece, they just used the generic scenery effects, I guess you would call them. Now, one thing that I wasn't really sure what that meant, because it said realms of battle are not used, right? Realms of battle are not used, right? But doesn't it say that round one was Star Strike and Gur? And then it gives round two, we have focal points in Ulgu, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I think that those are realm spells they have listed here. So did they just mean that there were no realm realm effects, as it were? Or what do you think they actually meant by that?
Yeah, I read this as no realm effects. No realmscapes.
Yeah, no realmscape effects. I mean, I would say, I guess that just wasn't very clear, because realms of battle to me is everything. That means we're not using realm spells, we're not using realm artifacts, none of that stuff. So I think that's pretty reasonable as far as that goes. Now, you know, as far as the number of players, I think there were just 25 players. That certainly when they show the ranking, they show the top 25. So I assume that there were, in fact, 25 players. What do you think on that?
You know, I can't really tell. You know, with them not using Best Coast bearings, it gets a little, you know, tricky, of course, to really take a look at all the details, and everything is hearsay unless you're actually there, which just adds another level of complexity.
Right. So I'm going to assume, honestly, that it was about 25, and that's also judging just looking at some of the photographs and stuff that were posted. I mean, it definitely wasn't 100 people. And then that, you know, scoring, pretty straightforward type stuff. They have a soft score. Basically, if you submit your list to tabletop.to, in the correct format, you get 10 points. And if your army was fully painted, you get another 20 points. After that, it's, you know, pretty classic Age of Sigmar, which is, you know, major wins give you a big bulk of points. Minor wins give you something less. Draw is somewhere in the middle. Minor loss is less points, and major loss is 0 points. They did allow two secondary missions, and you could max out 2 points. And you also, and this is something that I was talking with Chuck at during the Nova Open, and a couple other people actually I talked to about as well. So I think that this is something we might see going forward. Actually, I think the guys in Texas also did the same thing. But anyways, they're giving you points for denying your opponent's secondary objectives. So you get 2 points for your own and 2 points for that denial aspect. And I haven't played with the denial of opponent secondaries yet, so I don't even know how that's going to play out on the tabletop, but I'm interested. It intrigues me. I think it could be fun. And you know me, Alex, boy, I wish our buddy Garrett was here, because he and I definitely, you know, we see eye to eye on most things. And for years, he and I were very deep in the idea that we need more granularity of scoring. And then boom, all of a sudden I'm talking to him as we're approaching Nova, and he is now all about binary scoring. So now that we're on the backside of Nova, I really want to get into a great discussion with Garrett. Maybe you know, we should all set aside and just have a nice thorough discussion about granularity versus binary scoring. However, when I look at things like secondary missions and the ability to deny the opponent's secondary missions, giving a 4-point swing on top of your basic major minor win stuff, that might be just enough granularity to make things work. Did you take a look at the scoring for this at all, or have any thoughts on that?
I did, but I don't have too many thoughts to actually share right now about that. I honestly have always been all about granularity and making sure that you can keep it like that. And, you know, you bring up the fact that we have had this discussion a few times, which I agree is probably a good topic for an episode. You know, but for me, it's very much, I'm very much of the mind of respecting each TO's personal opinion on what they may want to run as these type of secondary objectives and how they choose to go about sorting them. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. I have no objections to every TO doing exactly what they want. Because what we see is the exact opposite in 40K ITC, where almost every TO runs pretty much the exact same event, which is not bad because players then get to practice and standardize, but it also means that there is very little variety in the average 40K event. Whereas with Age of Sigmar, you know, pretty much every event we go to is its own unique little flavor, tailor and tune our lists for what's going on, and kind of keeps things fresh, as it will.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the rules are still, you know, almost 90, if not a higher percentage of similarity, you know, that, like, but there may be different things, like, you know, this one has Realmscape features, but this one does not, you know, but this one allows mercenaries, but this one didn't specify. So the day of the event, the TO just goes, oh yeah, well, we're cool with mercenaries now.
Yeah. If somebody showed up with it, go for it. What the hell?
Yeah. The exact scenario happened at T-Shift with Michael Burke. yeah, but besides that, you know, it looks like an interesting event, and you know, I do know a few people who were there from the States. You know, our good friend Jeremy and co-host, he was there. He wasn't able to play, but
I didn't see his name on the list. If he played and wasn't on the list, then we know there were more than 25 players.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he was on the list, he'd be in first place.
No, he's not playing you, so he doesn't have a guaranteed win to get him there.
Okay. You know what?
So I'm just saying that if 20% of your games are a guaranteed win, it's a real advantage when you come to a GT. I'm just going to say that.
Sure. Great. But, you know, the event still, you know, it looked, you know, of course, as normal, they use a lot of, you know, uploading your list. They didn't use Best Coast Pairings. They used tabletop.to. And utilizing fully painted armies. And
now, are you familiar at all with tabletop.to by chance?
Nope, I am not. So I cannot speak regarding it.
I know nothing. This is like literally the first I've even heard about it as an app or a service or anything like that. So I'm just always curious to see what is out there.
I think it's something the Brits like. But just like normal, and just like you mentioned, you know, there are bonus points for denying your opponent's secondaries, and then of course major win, minor win, we all know about that. And then tiebreakers are strength of schedule. The other things that we need to look at are the fact that there were, a bunch of different awards, for the final standings. Of course, best general is certainly there. Looking at best appearance, best grand alliances. I thought that it was funny. There was one called Giant Killer. And it's for anyone who beats Darren Watson, who is last year's champ. So I think that's hilarious that there's an award for whoever can beat the one person who won last year.
And it says it was not awarded as Darren went undefeated.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. That is awesome. I wonder, I should reach out to Michael, who won the Winter Wars last year. And if he's coming back, I might offer a Giant Killer award as well. I think that's super fun. I
think
like that.
You could call it something that fits your theme a little more.
You're right. You're right. Of course,
I think
we would be
wonderful.
After a Yeti or something like that.
Yeah, I like that. That sounds like a lot of fun. There's also one that I would probably have won, Das Boot, which is a submarine commander. There's...
That's one that you would actually be pretty good
exactly.
at, probably.
Yeah, much to Jeremy's chagrin.
As long as you face Jeremy and Matthew day one, get them out of the way, then boom, rocket day two.
The thing is, I gotta tank my first day. I gotta tank my first game. That's the thing. That's the
he acts like he has this realization, not a freaking flow chart in the middle of one of his tattoos. Shh.
You're exposing me. I don't like this.
That's what happens. It's just you and me. Who else?
Yeah, that's fair.
Normally, I'd be here, and every time I'd speak up, Garrett would be like, "Oh, dude, you don't know what the hell you're talking to." Smack, smack, smack. But instead, I got no one stopping me, so it's like boom.
Yep, choo choo, ain't no brakes on this train. It looks interesting. I think it's fun that the top lists were things that were. I wouldn't necessarily say that they were unexpected at all. Daughters of Cain got first, Disciples of Zeench got second. I guess that would be slightly unexpected. Fire Slayers third, Skaven fourth, Flesh Eaters fifth. And then we go down the line with Grand Host, Eidneth, Blades, Iron Jaws, Sylvaneth, things like that. Something that I think...
The top 10 here, let's just look at that top 10 like you just read them off. No surprises. That is literally the center of the road of what somebody would expect to see winning a GT nowadays.
However, if you've noticed, our favorite army isn't there.
Oh, wait. Oh, they aren't. Were they not even allowed? Whoa. Slaanesh way down in 21st?
Yeah.
What the heck is going on
It could
here?
Just be a player-based thing. It could be that, let's not call it glorious European meta, let's call it the glorious Brexit meta. Maybe there just aren't a lot of Slaanesh players. I don't know what might be the reason for that, but I think it's interesting.
What else is interesting? There must have been more than 25 players, because actually as I'm looking at the scores... Everybody here that's listed has at least 3 wins. And the max is 2 losses. So the math says there must be a bunch of other players that aren't listed here.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely got to be a good population that we're just not seeing.
And so what we're not seeing is that like 26 through 57 are actually all Slaanesh players.
Yeah. For sure. we don't have that final run, but it is interesting to see. It's interesting to note. I'm just as Pardon me, I'm just as startled as you are to see that, Hedonites are not in the real top rung. So it's interesting. Yeah,
of course, my wife's favorite player, Jack Armstrong, coming in strong, fourth place with his Skaven list. Now, I remember last time we talked about this man, he was running something a little bit different. Now he's got your basic Grace here on a Screaming Bell, Warlock Bombardiers, and a whole lot of Clan Rats and Plague Monks. Yeah, 9 Storm Fiends. We see what's happening.
So there's a story here I don't know about. You said that it's Donna's favorite player, your lovely wife, Donna?
My lovely wife, Donna Armstrong.
Ah.
So she automatically is a fan of anybody with the last name Armstrong.
Got it. Okay. I was not aware of that. Okay.
Yes.
Learn something new.
So Jack, Neil, all of them, all fans around here.
Okay.
Small story there. I'm going to throw it out there. Why the heck? Armstrong. So my wife's family name actually has a coat of arms. The coat of arms is a blue shield with a large flexing arm and making a fist. So it's like an arm, pumping up the biceps there. And the story is that the Armstrong was a porter for a lord in ancient England. And after a lifetime of service, he was given a title and a coat of arms for having a strong arm. Therefore, he was the Armstrong.
There we go. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow, that's very cool. We learn something new every day, don't we, listeners?
If you listen to me enough, you'll learn something.
Oh, straight up, every 20 minutes. Cool. Well, that's very good to know. And of course, looking at all of the, looking at some of these main lists, it's interesting to me that Daughters of Cain are still doing so well. I'm not saying that they're bad, because they're far from it. They're an amazing army,
but you mean just because they're a year old and so much other stuff has come out since then?
I mean, just like we talked about with Hedonites, but that's just one of several, very strong armies that exist now. Fire Slayers are there in that top 10. You're looking at the, lovely Skaven are there in that top 10. There's some very, very strong armies that are out there nowadays. So
That's for sure. That's for sure. And armies that not all of them fare well against each other, too. So there's still a little rock, paper, scissors happening between some of the top armies.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Completely. So, it is just, to me, it's just very interesting that the results are as they are because of that fact and that fact alone. Now, What are some of your observations looking at these kind of top 5 lists here? Looking at the Fire Slayers run by Philip, looking at, Jack Armstrong Skaven, or even, Darren Watson's daughters.
So as far as that goes, these are, to me, pretty normal lists. And I say that from a perspective of a person who is, not an expert at Daughters of Cain, not an expert at Tzeentch, as it were. And honestly, I've only played Jeremy the one time with his Fire Slayers. That said, like everybody, I read the internet. I listen to podcasts. Heck, I even listen to our own podcast. So when I look at these things, I see what all the different units do. I see there in the Daughters of Cain, I see the mortal wounds coming back at me as I kill that unit there. Of course, Tzeentch nowadays is all about the summoning. And if you look at what's going on with that list, it is all about the summoning. I mean, what's that? 6 different endless spells going on there in the Darren Watson Tzeentch list. And Fire Slayers, again, I don't know that much about it to be able to talk about it. And of course, I did start to mention Jack Armstrong's Skaven list, which, it's a nice list. And it does have the a nice variety of tools. He has the 9 Storm Fiends, 40 Plague Monks. He has 60 Clan Rats, Warlock Bombardiers. So he's doing a lot of casting. He's got a lot of stuff to deal with some hordes. I mean, I tell you what, you go up against 3 of those Storm Fiends, they're going to be blowing some stuff apart with their wind launchers and rattling cannons and all that good stuff. And so that's that. Now, other than that, what I'm saying, Alex, is there's nothing super out of the ordinary. There's no special imaginative cool tech that I see being expressed on the tabletop here. You know, it's not like we have the cool, you know, 5 Vermin Lord, 12 endless spell list coming on the table or anything silly like that. These are just good, solid, refined lists. I imagine these people have been playing this stuff for a while. They've, you know, taken out all the fat from their list. They know what to do. They know what to do in the missions, and they're going in and tearing it up.
Yeah, I completely agree. And
actually, it's funny. I just noticed that there are 2 people with 5-0 scores. So let's see. For 2 people to be undefeated after 5 rounds, there has to be, what, more than 32 people?
Yes.
Yeah, so there had to have been at least 32, if not more. In fact, if I analyze how many 4-1s there are, that would probably decode how many total players there are, but I'm not going to do that live on the air. So nonetheless, therein is the secret to figuring these things out.
There we go. I like that. And yeah, it looks like there was, you know, again, great spread. Looks like a lot of fun, and congratulations on the winners. And with that being said, that does bring us to our unit review for today. It's been a few episodes since we've had one, just because of how busy everything has been, especially with Nova a little earlier. But I wanted to talk today about a unit that I have fought a lot against at Nova, and fought against yours, John. And of course, is that Greaseer on Screaming Bell. The guy is he is all business. You know, he only wears a suit and slicks back his hair like it's 1985. And yeah, there's nothing casual about it. I could go on, but you are our resident Skaven expert. So tell our listeners a little bit about the Screaming Bell.
Ah, the Screaming Bell, the famed Greaseer on a Screaming Bell. This is a unit that probably most long-term Skaven players have had one forever and have never played it or rarely used it because it has been a complete shit unit forever. But with the new Battle Tome, all of a sudden it is a must-have, must-play, top-tier unit. And pretty amazing how a few things can happen to change a unit around. So like myself, I've always ran 2 Plague Furnaces, and as soon as the new Battle Tome came out, one of those furnaces got converted back into a bell. So let's just get right into it. Of course, he's 13 wounds, 4 plus save, 6 bravery. Most of the Skaven like this are low bravery. He is actually pretty good in melee. All his attacks have rend 1, most of them hitting on 4s, wounding on 4s and 3s. We have a total of 7 plus d6 attacks, so there's a fair number of attacks. And the Rusty Spikes do hit on a 2 and do 2d6 attacks when you're charging. So he's actually a little bit better in melee than most people would expect. Now, the big Achilles heel on the Screaming Bell, just like with the Plague Furnace, is it cannot move unless there are 10 models within 6 inches at the when it actually decides to move. At first, that was messing me up a lot. I could tell you I had quite a few Screaming Bells sitting out on their own, Plague Furnaces sitting on their own, stuck, not doing anything. And mind you, Alex, as far as I can tell, that means you can't charge, you can't gnaw hole, you can't pile in, you can't do anything. There is no moving unless there's 10 models within 6 inches. Beyond that, this thing gives us a 13-inch bubble of immune to battle shock. It has a 5-up feel no pain. And the big thing, other than being a wizard, of course, it's a wizard. It can cast 2 spells. It can deny 2 spells. Crack's Call is the spell itself, casting value 6. Pick an enemy unit within 18 inches. Roll 2d6. If the roll is greater than that unit's move characteristic, that unit suffers a mortal wounds number of mortal wounds equal to the difference between its move characteristic and the roll. Now, that sounds pretty amazing when you're facing against, you know, Death and Dwarves and Khorne and all these guys with 5-inch moves. Every time I roll the 2d6, I roll a 5 or a 6 against those. So where it seems like Crack's Call would be amazing, I have yet to roll that big 12 against a 5-inch moving or 4-inch moving unit. So No big thing there. But really, why are people taking the Screaming Bell? All this stuff is decent. Now, it's probably worth mentioning that the Grey Seer is 140 points, and the Grey Seer on the Screaming Bell is 220 points. So for an extra 80 points, you are gaining 7 wounds, as well as a whole lot of attacks and other abilities. And the real thing, the real deal of the Screaming Bell, this is why anybody who has had a bad day from this thing, this is why our buddy James runs 2 of them, and that is the Peal of Doom. At the start of your hero phase, if you're playing against a Skaven player, and this isn't the first thing they do, maybe they can roll to see whether they get some extra command points. You might consider denying them. Oh, what? I didn't say that. Anyways, at the start of your hero phase, roll 2d6 for this model and look up the results on the table below. The range of the Peal of Doom is shown on the damage table above. So as you take damage, the Peal of Doom loses range. It starts out at 26 inches. Once you're down to 2 wounds, it only has a 10-inch range. At about 6 to 8 wounds left, 6 to 8 wounds suffered, you're at 18-inch range. So still pretty good range until you get down to the bottom level. And what you do is you roll 2d6, and when you roll the 2d6, you look up on this table. And the table is actually pretty easy once you understand how it works. So we start right in the center at 7. If you roll a 7, which is the average on 2d6, you get +1 casting for all Skaven-tied wizards on the board. Okay? Notice it does say friendly, so know if you're playing against another Skaven player, they don't get a bonus from your bell. Now, if we're below 7, we have a series of reduced effects. So 5 and 6, you roll for each enemy unit within range of the bell, 26 inches. On a 4+, that unit suffers 1 mortal wound. On a 3 or 4, you add d6 to your move characteristic. And on a 2, each unit within 3 inches suffers d3 mortal wounds. Okay, so 7 is average, gives you +1 to casting. Anything below 7 is a reduced effect, though 5 and 6 at causing 1 mortal wound, it's okay. But when you go above 7, now you have amplified effects. You have increased power effects. So 8 and 9 is the Apocalyptic Doom. Roll a dice for each enemy unit within the range of this model's Peal of Doom. On a 4+, that unit suffers D3 mortal wounds. My friends, that is a 26-inch, and if you look at the size of the Grey Seer and the Screaming Bell's base, you're actually closer to a 30-inch bubble, a 30-inch bubble, where every enemy unit on a 4+ takes D3 mortal wounds. I have nuked the heck out of some people's armies that. In fact, when Jack and I played at Nova, it was my bell ringing on turn 5, getting the Apocalyptic Doom, was the only reason I won that game. Otherwise, he would have had it in the bag at that point. Then, for a 10 and 11, we have a Wall of Unholy Sound, and that is going to make your enemies -1 to hit. Enemies are -1 to hit. Yep. And of course, for a 12, what everybody's going for, you summon a Vermin Lord. Vermin Lord of your choice has to be within the range of the Peal of Doom and 9 inches from an enemy model. And if you summon, if you roll a 12 a second time, your Vermin Lord heals 12 wounds. And I've had that happen too, where I had a Vermin Lord down to like 3 wounds, rolled that second 12. Boom! He's all the way at full health, and you can't pay money to get that kind of a look on your opponent's face. So the entertainment is for real at that point. So Alex, my gosh, I think I just talked for like 5 minutes straight, but that is everything on the Screaming Bell. Tell me about how you have gotten the bad touch from the Screaming Bell.
Well, I mean, I've gotten bad touches, and I've gotten some good touches, and you know, it really depends on a few situations there. You know, the Screaming Bell, in my opinion, is one of the best hero units in the game, just because of all the
things. Yeah, it's not even a monster, right?
Yeah, it's not a monster. You have a lot of benefits involved. One of the best things involved is the fact that you know, it has this keel, and it is again a level 2 caster. Almost all Skaven wizards are level 2 casters for the most part, anyways. So you got a lot of access to a lot of abilities here, and he's not too expensive. You know, I would actually say he's probably undercosted.
His limitations of movement is what keeps his cost down, I think.
Yeah, maybe. And most of the time, you're always going to have to be able to move him. What I've done and what I've enjoyed doing is I've enjoyed completely eliminating all the rats near him and then just ignoring him. And like, sure, get your keel off and your spells off, but you're now like in this super inconvenient spot, and that's where you'll stay for the game.
I've had that happen to me. It's the worst.
Yeah. Fighting against it, I haven't found it to be very offensive at all, but I also play an army that ignores rend. But you know, it's also not a lot of damage when it goes through. You know, it's a lot of one damage items. I think just the staff is not one damage, right?
Yeah. The claws and fangs do two damage, but everything else is one.
Yeah. So I haven't been too impressed on like the offensive ability, but yeah, just the keel itself is huge. You know, and it always like the one that I don't want it to be is always the one it ends up becoming, you know, like, oh man, like now my entire army is minus one to hit against his arm.
Right.
That sure does suck. You know, or, you know, insert other scenario that is less ideal for me.
Like when you get the avalanche of energy and then you have Master of Magic on your Vermin Lord Warp Seer, who's also standing next to a Nahul. So now you're plus three to cast. Thank you very much.
I don't want to talk about it. definitely 1000% has happened to me. Yeah, that is rough. That is rough stuff. And it's a very strong army. So, I mean, it makes complete sense to me.
Other than that, you know, I would say it's actually a pretty decent model to build. Any of these Skaven models that are kind of wood structures, and some of these ones that are older kits, you're going to find that you're going to spend a lot of time deburring, removing mold lines and all of that. And just when you think you've got them all, you throw some paint on there, you'll find the rest of them. So
yep,
a lot of time deburring it, a little bit of fiddliness with the assembly and build. It's a spiky model. So mine, pretty much something breaks off almost every time I play with it. In fact, sitting on my workbench right now is the Skaven symbol that broke off the top of mine at the Nova Open. And here's a couple of the blades from the front of it. And I would say that the paint job potentially could take some work. But as you guys know, I accidentally primed mine 2 days before Nova, and I was able to paint him to a decent tabletop standard with contrast paints and dry brushing in 2 days. So paint job's not too bad on him, I guess.
No, I was saying you did a pretty good job on your paint job.
Yeah, thank you. I got the points at least. And so that's that. But I tell you what, going from a unit that was pretty much a zero, that I didn't even bother to own for the last several years that I've been playing Skaven, to a unit that has been in pretty much every single list that I have put on the table in the last 6 months, it says a lot for how radically this unit has changed.
Yeah, I agree. Especially, you know, I honestly had no idea that you had taken your Screaming Bell. I was like, nope, we're changing this up. Or not Screaming Bell, Plague Furnace. That's really interesting to me. I'm glad that there's added utility here and that, you know, it's been able to work out to Skaven players' advantages. And, you know, you mentioned James a little earlier, bringing two.
Yep. You know,
his final game in Nova was Duality of Death, which was round 5. And yep, he suddenly rolled his 2d6 on both of them because he got turn 1 against a Khorne player, and he rolled 2 12s. So at the start of the game, he was playing 700 points up.
At least 700 points up.
Yeah, with two...
At least 600, maybe as much as 700.
Feels bad.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. I bet James felt real good after that. But, you know, it's funny. It's one of those things, Alex, that when you get the bad touch, you'll remember it. That guy that got that rolled against will talk about for the rest of his life how broken this thing is. Okay, I've been playing this unit for 6 months. I've summoned 4 Vermin Lords in that entire time. I summoned 0 Vermin Lords during the entire Nova GT. Okay, so it does happen, but odds say it only happens 1 in 36 games. Or, excuse me, 1 in 6 games, maybe. 1 in 7 games. That is assuming you're rolling every turn.
Yeah. And you play it at the entirety, you know, so.
Yeah, it doesn't get killed, all that other good stuff, which once people get hit with one or two of the big nukes, they usually put some effort into killing this thing.
Yeah, and unless it has, like, the ethereal amulet, it's not the most resilient unit in the game.
Well, it does have a feel no pain, so it does have that, but yeah, it dies, you know. You can give it the suspicious stone to give it a double feel no pain, and I run it that way a lot myself, so I'll make it my warlord, give it master of magic, warlord trait, and then give it the suspicious stone, and give it the, did I say suspicious stone? I'm sorry. Give it the suspicious stone for the plus one magic, but give it the warlord trait that allows him to pass off the wounds, and then that's what you're doing there. No, it was a suspicious stone. I'm sorry. You know what, Alex? It is time for us to call this at an end. I poured myself a double of the Glenlivet, and I am just finishing it off right now. So,
perfect.
And with that is might be the last cogent thing I say this evening.
And with that, yeah, it certainly is going to be a good time to wrap things up. So, you know, for our listeners, again, if you guys do enjoy this episode, do feel free to tell us what you like. Tell us what you would like to hear on the podcast. And as always, do like us on Facebook. Leave us a review. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts as well. We're always happy to hear from you. But this is going to be John and I signing off for the night. You guys have a great week.
Good night, folks. Have a good one.
Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all the time thing. You don't win once in a while, and you don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. Winning is a habit.